I regressed N2 versus Bitcoin price, and I saw like 70%.
Yeah. So I guess what you have to ask yourself is, you know, what's different this time? And I think before, you know, we really were in a different regime potentially, yep. And we could be setting up for a new regime where that might not explain as much.
Always with these kind of signals that they seem very good and they actually might actually be very good, there's always caveats to it. And every time you see a big drop or a big increase, and therefore you're trying to justify a big drop or increase in Bitcoin, you really need to dig and understand what is the reason why global money supply has been going down over the past weeks. And if you look at it, I mean, actually, banks, central banks around the world, they haven't really been extremely tight. If anything, they're relatively loose. That means that money supply has been growing. But on the other hand, in absolute terms, at least, you see that the money supply has been decreasing. And if you really look into it, I think it has to do with the fact that USD has been appreciating, which effectively means that since that is a metric, is USD denominated, then you see depreciating against the USD. And effectively it means people can buy less dollars and therefore less Bitcoin.
You're listening to CFB Talks Digital Assets, the home of informed conversation about crypto for institutions building the future of finance, presented by CF Benchmarks. Hey everybody, thanks for joining us for another episode of CFB Talks Digital Assets. I'm Ken Odelica, Head of Content, and as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, Gabe Selby, who's Head of Research, and Mark Filipchuk, who's a Research Analyst. And additionally, of course, we're pleased to welcome back Christian Isaac, who's a quant researcher for CF Benchmarks. So hi again, Christian. How are you getting along?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks for asking. Excited and very pleased to be here. I think, first of all, congratulations are in order. You guys have been doing a great job with these podcast series. Very high quality, very impressive guests. And once again, very happy to be with you.
Yeah, indeed. It is a particularly interesting episode again. It is whenever Christian is with us. Today, we have something slightly different of interest for all quantitative researchers, allocators, institutional investment professionals in general, and we think anyone who's interested in digital assets, you know, as an asset class more broadly. We are going to talk about factors in crypto assets. Now, factor-based investing, what is it? Very, very briefly. Factor-based investing, how do you do it? You essentially try to identify market characteristics, and then once you've identified them and defined them, you try to determine their ability, their strength, their robustness in basically generating returns, or at least explaining return distributions. So that's essentially what we're going to talk about today. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, of course, factor-based investing is massive in traditional finance. Not so much in crypto. In fact, quite difficult to credibly execute in crypto till now, because what CF Benchmarks has done in the recent weeks is published a research paper called A Factor Model for Digital Assets. And it does exactly what it says on the tin. It is probably the first institutional grade factor-based investing model, if you want to put it that way, for the crypto asset class. And of course, Christian is the driving force of it and author of the paper, along with a couple of others. But of course, Christian has led this project, so he's the expert on it. So Christian, basically, where would you like to start in terms of explaining how this is going to work?
Yeah, well, this paper is really about vindicating crypto as a fully fledged asset class and in its own right. And so for too long, crypto has been plagued by stigma, if you will, whether it's been because of the fallout from the FTX calamity or the perception that it riddled with these scams and speculation. With this paper, we are in fact rejecting the notion that crypto is just a random walk. That is, that its performance is random. Instead, we demonstrate that there are systematic risk factors, real measurable drivers of crypto returns, just like in traditional finance. And we are applying a very familiar model, the well-known TradFi risk factor model, to what really is a unique asset class. And so our goal is to essentially bridge the gap between traditional asset pricing models and cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrencies are, as you know, unique because of their transparency, but also because of their volatility, and also because of their blob-based nature and its ecosystems. And they also bring a unique data that is not available in TradFi. Think of these fees and user activity that can be queried from the blockchain at any time and that are updated every second. On the contrary, in TradFi, you have to really wait for quarterly earning reports, which introduces significant uncertainty. I mean, a lot can happen from one quarter to another for investors' portfolios. Taking a step back, by identifying these systematic factors with the unique future that crypto brings, we really provide a framework that helps investors construct and optimize portfolios while effectively managing risk. So in short, this paper brings rigor and credibility to the crypto space, giving investors the tools to make informed decisions in a market that's often seen as chaotic.
Thanks, Christian, for a brief summary, and welcome to the podcast. You know, here in the US, we've been really focused on primarily Bitcoin and Ether. We've seen those two tokens be launched in spot ETF form. And that's kind of like where the institutions are at right now, right? We haven't really been able to kind of tread too deep into the water and go into to altcoins yet. So I just wanted to ask, you know, why do you think this type of research is so urgent in this time to be analyzing what could be 50 to 100 tokens and crypto factors?
I think cryptocurrencies are really at a critical moment of maturity. Institutional investors are entering the space. You only have to look at the fund flows that we've seen in the ETF so far. But they also are starting, I think, or at least will start to need these structured frameworks that are used to in traditional finance. So without these, it's hard to navigate the risks and opportunities in once again, a very volatile market. By addressing this gap, we are not just improving, for instance, risk management or allowing to optimize portfolios. We're really helping to shape the narrative around crypto as a serious and investable asset class.
So let's dig into this. This is really exciting, I have to say. Where should we begin? I think with the paper, which is what is going to, you know, it's going to be the focus of this conversation, I think. Now, one thing that struck me reading it is that the paper and the research methodology itself, in fact, are grounded in a long tradition of research within the field of factor-based investing. You know, there's a lot of familiar names for people who are, you know, aware of the space, who are kind of in the investment, institutional investment space. They'll be familiar with a lot of the names. So clearly, that suggests that the research methodology is grounded in what we could call traditional methodologies that, you know, have been utilized for factor-based investing for, you know, established asset classes. Some are more well-known, some are less well-known. But what would be your main suggested takeaway for readers of the literature section in the paper?
Sure. In traditional finance, we got models like the CAPM and the Fama French that have been used for decades to explain why certain investments perform the way they do, as you just mentioned. CAPM, or which stands for Capital Asset Pricing Model, essentially suggests that the return of an asset, like, take for instance, Apple, is largely explained by the return of the overall market, often proxied by the S&P 500 in the case of the US. For example, if the market rises 10%, Apple stock might rise proportionally depending on its sensitivity to the market. And you know, it is widely acknowledged, however, that the market factor in the CAPM model may not capture all systematic risks influencing asset return. Fama French addresses this by introducing additional factors such as size, where essentially smaller companies are viewed as riskier, but offer higher risk premium. And the reason for this is because, well, small companies being small, they have naturally fewer resources and therefore are perceived as riskier. And these factors capture additional systematic risks, if you will, beyond that explained by the CAPM market factor. And here's the cool part about it. When we apply these ideas to crypto, we see some overlap. Factors like markets, size, or momentum still matter. But crypto also introduces entirely new dimensions, like total value locked or users' activity, which reflect blockchain activity and using engagement. And so crypto takes these familiar concepts and builds on them with blockchain-specific metrics, reflecting its sort of decentralized and technology-driven nature.
Let me just do a quick sidebar, actually. In the course of this conversation, we're going to have a mix of assuming a lot in terms of your pre-installed knowledge, because just the nature of this podcast, right? But at times, you know, we will try to sort of drill down a little bit to sort of like provide a little bit more background for people who may not be fully familiar. So obviously, Eugene Farmer, a very, very well-known name in the space of financial markets and financial market research, academic research. French, not necessarily so well known, but you know, basically the pair, these researchers have gone in pairs over the last 30, 40 years, I think even. One thing I wanted to ask you real quick, Christian, define the market factor. It sounds so simple, but it is actually quite important to understand what it is exactly. So if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, well, the market factor is very simple. Here we're talking about some, just in the same spirit as I shown with traditional finance, where the market is defined by the S&P 500, which is basically the largest 500 company in the S&P. Well, in crypto, we, in a simplified manner, define the market as by Bitcoin and Ethereum, since they broadly reflect the market returns. And so these market returns are precisely, you know, the factor that we define as the market factor. As we will see later, usually this factor is precisely the one that accounts for the most variability in returns. We'll delve a bit deeper into it later in the episode. Sure.
Christian, maybe could you elaborate a little bit more on how you all approach this research and building on these existing factor models such as CAPM? And maybe just go in a little bit deeper into the context of, you know, how that works in the crypto space.
Well, look, our research really builds on top of models like the CAPM and Farmer French by sort of adapting their principles to the unique dynamics of cryptocurrencies. And while CAPM highlights market risk as the primary driver of returns, and Farmer French expands this with factors like size and value, our research really incorporates crypto-specific metrics such as total value locked and on-chain activity. And this demonstrates that while market risk remains dominant, additional factors like, you know, growth, value, downside beta, as I will show later, are critical for explaining crypto returns. Unlike traditional finance, where metrics rely on earnings or book value, once again, crypto really offers real-time blockchain native data that provides deeper insights. And by tailoring these models to the decentralized and transparent nature of digital assets, we bridge traditional frameworks with the unique complexities of crypto.
Yeah, and touching more on some of those metrics that we're using that are a little different than traditional finance, could you go into and explain a little bit how the data is collected and what some of the differences are in the data and how we kind of cleaned everything up?
Yeah, absolutely. The data for this study comes really from multiple sources. We primarily used exchange public APIs to gather order book data and transactional data. Additionally, we also naturally utilize blockchain node and open source smart contract parsers to extract on-chain metrics such as protocol fees, total value lock, active users, token supply, and so on. And I realize we're getting a bit technical here, but I don't want our audience to get scared by things like blockchain nodes and open source smart contract classes. This is really just a big database from where we can query these metrics. And so to validate the robustness of our data, we cross-reference it with third-party platforms like Token Terminal, which is a fundamental data provider. The data itself spans from January 1st of 2015 to November 10th of 2024. And was collected on a daily frequency.
Christian, just real quick. I think a lot of people who are watching this, who are, you know, interested in it, they believe it, you know, they can see that it's credible. One thing that would actually be beneficial, I think, is your perspective when you were embarking on this research. At what point did you stop being surprised that you could actually map this traditional methodology onto the crypto world? Because as you say, we're talking about on-chain data, some of the stuff. I mean, I can understand a little bit. I'm not deep in the weeds, interrogating the blockchain. But there's that nature of data that you're utilizing, as well as a whole ream of other things. And yet, you're still able to actually utilize this very traditional methodology that originates in an asset class, which is universes away. At what point did you stop being surprised about that?
Look, we began by analyzing the raw data at first. So we looked at market cap and we looked at on-chain metrics. In particular, we looked at their pairwise correlations. I mean, the intuition behind the economic rationale between them are quite self-explanatory. What's interesting is to first look how they correlate with all these other traditional metrics. And our goal was to identify meaningful relationships about metrics, such as low or highly correlated ones, which will be relevant during the factor building exercise, and thereby help us isolate unique potential return drivers for digital assets. For example, we observe a strong correlation between fees and total value locked, as both reflect a proxy for protocol utility. We then built our investable universe, which is very important, which was reconstituted on a quarterly basis to ensure stability, and was composed of the top 50 assets run by market capitalization and that satisfied liquidity criteria. And we did so to ensure replicability from an investor side, which is key in this case. Next, we moved on to using these correlations to compute long-short portfolios, which is a very common approach in factor modeling. Namely, long positions were taken in the top 50 assets of assets ranked by specific descriptor, take for instance, cumulative performance over the past 2 weeks. And short positions were taken in the bottom 50. So the long short portfolio was given by the spread between these two portfolios. And by the way, these portfolios were equally weighted, by the way, to avoid concentration only in Ethereum or Bitcoin. That's really how we started about it. And that's how we also started to come to the realization that they're all not that different, were it not for these, you know, on-chain data, which is really the most unique and the very fascinating part. But
maybe we can jump back to that on-chain data and back to kind of Mark's point. Maybe help the listeners understand what are some of the nuances of working with a metric like fees from a blockchain. Are there any sort of adjustments or are there any sort of issues that could arise? Maybe the quality of the data. How have we kind of mitigated some of those potential hurdles that could be impacting, you know, the results of your factor models?
That's actually a very important point. And it also falls in the category of ensuring robustness. We had to do that in order to ensure that our result was just not a stroke of luck. And so to that end, we examined, just get it back at the long short portfolios, we examined the performance of these portfolios across different rebalancing periods, weekly, daily, monthly. We also looked at different investable universes, top 30 versus top 50, and different descriptor variations. Just think of the different possible lookback windows to compute, for instance, fee growth. You know, you could do it over 30 days, you could do it over 15 days, over whatever that might be. Following all this, to give an example, and following your example, Gabe, in the case of protocol fee growth, which is a descriptor that we looked at, we found that weekly rebalanced long-short portfolios based on the top 50 assets demonstrated strong and consistent performance over time, making it therefore eligible for further analysis and therefore a potential contributor to a growth-like factor. So this in combination with correlation analysis that I mentioned earlier and the economic rationale is how we determine, you know, which descriptors are meaningful and how we analyze those on-chain metrics and in which factor they had to go. And just to finish, one last thing that I'd like to mention is, you know, we also examined the performance of the long-short portfolios during different monetary policy regimes. So, namely a loose, a neutral, and a tight one. And for example, we found that the 30 days fee growth metrics performed really very nicely throughout the entire period. It didn't really, regardless of the monetary policy. But momentum was, on the other hand, quite vulnerable to tight regimes. And actually, the last thing, if you allow me, more importantly, perhaps, I would like to point out that one very important thing is that the full year of 2024 on our analysis is out of sample. And we did so to further ensure, you know, robustness.
Sure. We're going to talk about, obviously, you know, everyone's dying to hear about the results, the outcomes of all this. But I just want to wrap up this session. We've actually started kind of inadvertently, slightly consciously, talking about data availability, because clearly that is a really critical issue. And one thing I want to underscore, because I think maybe not giving yourself full credit here, Christian, one thing that really struck me from the paper, and I'm going to read a section of it. The data framework leverages, I'm paraphrasing, but here we are with some quotes. A broad scope of CF benchmarks sourced data and resources to ensure a comprehensive examination of data quality. And then it goes on to say something like data environments utilized include Exchange APIs, blockchain nodes, open source tools, and other such sources to gather transaction and on-chain metrics on things such as like transaction fees, TVL, total value locked, active user metrics, among others. And with these data in hand, the study focuses on the top 50 cryptocurrencies by market capitalization, excluding stables, derivatives, and other pegged assets in order to ensure reliability. Now, we might be able to get this chart up on video for our viewers or people watching clips, but there's a really impressive chart. I believe it's figure one from the paper, and it basically depicts the data within those categories between 2016 and 2024. And, you know, the line, obviously, the axis is, you know, cryptocurrencies, the top 50 along the time-based. Basically, it shows a massive shooting up of the line at just beyond 2017 to underline that there was no shortage of data of these kinds. And clearly, it has been thoroughly validated and established that it's of good provenance. So therefore, just to sort of basically underscore the idea that this factor-based model is based on data of the highest quality. And yeah, there's a lot of it, right? Is that a fair assessment, Christian?
I think that's more than fair. more than fair. Just one thing of note, you know, there's data that becomes available since the beginning of our sample, which is 2015. There's some that starts becoming available from 2017. But it's very important to note as well that on-chain data per se, like fees and total value locked, which really started to grow with the boom of DeFi, it starts towards 2020.
Okay. So let's dig into results. And I want one of you guys, Gabe or Mark or both, to actually tear the first piece off this aspect, because this clearly is where the real meat is. So go for it.
So kind of thinking about factors and where they fit into portfolios in TradFi, we'll just take a step there. We can really use them as portfolio managers to kind of look at our sources of returns and our sources of risk within the portfolio. So looking at the factor results for the cryptocurrency market, what are some of the findings that you think are key for portfolio managers to be thinking about as they allocate the digital assets?
Well, that's a good question, and it's a long one.
That's fine. Go for it, man. Go for it.
I'm gonna try to keep it concise. I'm going to try to keep it in several parts, perhaps, and several bullet points. But first, I want to share with you the key and the foundational results. We'll start with the market factor. And we constructed this factor using a market cap weighted portfolio of Bitcoin and Ethereum, which, as you may know, pretty much dominates the market and efficiently reflects broader trends. And so this factor showed a strong and annualized return of roughly 81% with a Sharpe ratio slightly above one, which is no news. I mean, we all know that the asset class has had a very impressive performance. The second factor we've looked into was the size factor, which we measured using the fully diluted market cap of assets. And based on the hypothesis that small assets outperform large ones, just as in TradFi. And results revealed a significant risk premium of roughly 9% annualized return with a sharp ratio of 0.5. And perhaps getting more into more interesting stuff, the value factor, we defined it as the average of two very unique on-chain descriptors, which is the ratio of fees to total value locked and the ratio of daily active users to market cap. And these metrics reflect a proxy of the protocol's utility and intrinsic value. More importantly, note here the unique and crypto-specific data that we can obtain once again from real-time on-chain data that again is dispersed effectively every second. And this is truly something unique and novel that one does not observe in TradFi. This factor in particular yielded a annualized return of roughly 13% with a Sharpe ratio of 0.84, confirming that undervalued protocols with efficient resource use generate higher risk premium than their counterpart. Now, momentum factor, which is another factor that we looked at, constructed using the average of the 2 weeks cumulative performance Z-score and the risk-adjusted Z-score. And we did it this way. We chose a short window to basically reflect the velocity with which crypto markets change, and also included a risk-adjusted metric to account for crypto volatility. And we also observed an annualized return of 13% roughly and a Sharpe ratio of 0.8. Obviously, this also demonstrates that momentum strategies are effective in identifying short-term trends, namely that winners outperform losers. And growth factor, and I'm counting three more factors to go, we base it on the 30-day fee growth and 30-day daily active user growth, Z-scores, which is sort of a reflection of the network adoption and ecosystem expansion. Again, this is a unique metric to crypto assets, just as the metrics for the value factor. And result also, actually showed a pretty impressive significant risk premium of roughly 25% annualized return and a Sharpe ratio of just under 1.5, meaning that high growth assets significantly outperformed low growth
ones.
Downside beta factor. The downside beta factor, we estimated by regressing in an asset's return against market returns during downturns. So okay. Only when the market returns were negative, and therefore measuring the sensitivity to adverse market conditions. Okay. Despite an initial crash in late 2017 for this specific factor, it still displayed an adjusted annualized return of roughly 5% and a Sharpe of 0.3. Proving valuable and showing lower downside beta assets outperform their counterparts, albeit it can incur significant downturns during bull periods.
Yeah.
Coming up on the last factor, the liquidity factor, we define it using token turnover as a percentage of circulating supply, basically capturing the ease of trading a given asset. And this factor revealed an annualized risk premium of 3%. With a Sharpe of 0.2, showcasing basically that the spread between low liquidity assets and high liquidity ones is positive, albeit weaker than the above factor. Nonetheless, we keep this factor as it may still hold significant explanatory power in a Fama French or Fama McGrath setting.
That's really interesting. I just wanted to jump in real quick. Give a little plug to the paper here. So for the listeners, it might be helpful to follow along if you are currently listening on Spotify, go to our website. We've got the paper on there. And on page 23, we've got this great table that kind of stacks all seven factors. It's on page 23, starts with the market factor, and then it kind of does these permutations, market and size, market plus value, market plus downside beta, and it stacks each one and shows the median R squared. And you can kind of see how as you add these seven defined variables, you kind of generally see an increase to the R-squared. And ultimately, once you get all seven in there, you have the highest R-squared explaining price. One thing that I just wanted to say is when we look at factors and how practitioners use factors, what Mark was saying is really true. And not just, from a performance attribution standpoint or understanding your drivers or your performance, but also from a risk management standpoint, right? So one exercise would be, analyzing your portfolio of stocks, or in this case, digital assets, and taking a look and seeing, do I have too much market risk? Am I exposed to too much beta? And so what we've done, which is really, really cool, is on the CF Benchmarks factor paper, Christian, you and your team is create a table of all of the investable universe, tokens from, you know, Cardano all the way down to XRP in alphabetical order. And it shows you kind of the underlying factor values, right, of these seven factors on these assets. And that's exactly how a practitioner would look at it. You'd say, okay, look, I want to be a little more defensive going into the next quarter. Maybe I'm going to reduce my exposure to tokens that have higher market risk. Maybe I'll reduce my exposure to the ones that have more downside beta or lower liquidity. So it becomes kind of a very like kind of X-ray. It's like an X-ray tool and analyzing your portfolio in a different sense versus just traditional attribution performance, right?
If I may just expand a bit on your comment just now, and also what Mark was asking earlier on how should investors think about these factors when contracting portfolios? Well, as you mentioned, the most trivial one is they essentially help decompose portfolio returns and identify key drivers, and therefore providing transparency and into performance and risk exposure. So that's the most trivial one. Another one that I actually find very interesting is investors can actually sort of deviate by underweighting or overweighting their portfolio benchmark weight based on specific factors. So for example, momentum, to try to get that extra alpha in one's portfolio. I think this is something also a very interesting use case. Third, factors can also enable market-specific strategies. And what I mean here is, for instance, prioritizing growth during bullish condition or downside beta during market downturns. It's an effective instrument that investors can use to express their market view. So overall, they provide a systematic framework, if you will, to optimize portfolios and balance the diversification and even to express views.
Yeah, this is actually music to my ears because what it puts me in mind of is just the kind of commentary, you know, having been around markets for maybe a few too many years, the kind of commentary that you generally hear portfolio managers make when they're talking about traditional assets and factor-based investing with those asset classes. So what it obviously implies is that, you know, that those kind of sort of like tactics and strategies that you can actually execute with traditional assets, once you've been given a set of validated factors, you can actually start to think about with the digital asset class as well, which is obviously extremely promising.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, once again, this paper, what it's showing is that we are really applying a familiar risk model factor to a unique asset class that comes with those features that I mentioned earlier, especially on the on-chain data side.
Okay. All right. So, you know, we've sort of taken a tour through the literature and also the factors, the descriptors, and then our methodology and how we try to validate them. Let's look at the models that have arisen out of this exercise. So, to enable us to better understand the crypto performance returns and, you know, their strength and robustness in doing so. So I think maybe the way to get into this, Christian, is to start talking about the models themselves. So take it away.
Just because we find certain portfolios, in this case long-short portfolios, to have significant risk premium or even an impressive one, it need not necessarily mean that those significant risk factors that we find in terms of significant risk premiums, it need not mean that they actually have the explanatory power to explain crypto return. And so in order to ensure that that's the case, we need to take a few steps. Namely, we looked into two models. And I will start with the first one, which is the well-known from a French model. As I explained earlier, just to give our viewers a brief understanding of what this model is.
Yeah.
This is a model aimed at explaining the change in crypto return. Take Bitcoin, for example. The implication in this setting, in this model, is that its returns can be explained by factors that I just mentioned now. In slightly more technical terms, what is computed here are the sensitivities of a given asset to changes in the risk factors, or what we call the beta. For example, how much does Bitcoin's price move if the market moves 1 percentage point, or if the momentum factor moves 5 percentage points, and so on.
Excellent.
And To determine whether their impact is significant, we run several analyses to ensure that our results are not just a stroke of luck. Namely, we run regressions for over 100 assets against these factors, and we first looked whether these factors were statistically significant on average in explaining each asset's return. We did so by looking at their t-statistics and found that all seven factors were found to be significant. And as expected, the market factor was the one that was most commonly significant for each asset, because it is typically the factor that captures most of the variation. And by the way, this is completely expected, and this is what we observe in TradFi as well. The remaining factors, value, growth, downside beta, and so on, were significant for less assets when compared to the market factor, which is, again, this is in line with what we observe in TradFi and what makes intuitively sense. And it's also reflecting the diverse characteristics of different cryptocurrency. Gabe was mentioning earlier, some assets are strictly growth and momentum assets. Some assets are more value, and so on. As something very important here, the constant term, or the alpha in these regressions, this was virtually not significant in most cases, showcasing the model does a good job at capturing baseline returns, which naturally adds to the robustness of results. And this is something we want to see. If you'll allow me, I'd like to point two more things.
Sure, go for it.
Furthermore, more factors were added. The more factors that were added, rather, the R-square improved, which is, again, something that Gabe was pointing to earlier. Namely, it increased from roughly 38% from a market-only model that includes only market factor up to 45% when adding all factors. This might seem not too high, but this is actually, again, very in line with what we observe in TradFi models. So we basically are able to explain almost half of the variation in crypto returns by adding these factors. For robustness purposes, we also looked at the variation in the constant term and found that simpler models like the market-only model has a higher median constant term, around 7 basis points, whereas when you include more factors, you can go as low as 51 basis points that is not explained.
Perfect. So that's the Farmer-French model, right? The first model. And looking at the second model, which is the Farmer-Macbeth model, I think, very briefly, Christian, how does it differ? And then, of course, you know, how meaningful that was with respect to your observations within the universe.
The second model is as you point out, the Farmer-Macbeth model, which is a two-step regression approach designed to analyze how risk factors explain cross-sectional returns at different points in time. It is very similar to the Farmer-French approach mentioned earlier. Actually, its first step is to compute the sensitivities or the betas of a given asset that we were talking about before. So Farmer-French is basically the first.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
The second step of the Farmer-Macbeth model takes the betas or sensitivities that we calculated in the first stage and uses them to figure out how much return each risk factor contributes across different assets on a weekly basis. So we do it via weekly cross-sectional regression. So this is a bit technical, but you can think of it this way. Once we know how sensitivities each asset, what the sensitivities of each asset is to a factor, we look at the actual weekly returns for those assets and calculate how much those returns can be explained by the factor. And these estimated parameters from this regression are the weekly factor risk premiums themselves. So in other words, it aims at answering the following questions. Do assets, for example, with higher momentum beta, translate into higher weekly returns for those assets? Do assets that assume higher momentum risk display higher returns? This is what we're fundamentally doing, and we do it for all the factors.
Perfect. So then the next question is a bit of a layup, of course. The comparison, you know, how did the results look, you know, comparatively for each model? So maybe you want to start off with the Farmer-French model first and then move on to the outcomes and the sort of observations for the Farmer-Macbeth model and compare them.
As mentioned earlier, Farmer-French, we've seen that all factors are significant And we looked at different analyses. We looked at how significant or how frequently the factors are significant across the different assets. We also looked at how does the R square, that is, how much does the variation in explaining returns change when including more factors? And we found that indeed including them increases significantly. We also looked at at the alpha, which in principle you should expect for the constant term to shrink towards zero, and we also saw that as we increase more factors. The results for the Fama Macbeth are directionally the same as in the Fama French model. So to evaluate the model significance in the Fama Macbeth case, we also looked at the statistics of all factors, which basically tell you if a factor is significant or not. On average, 30 statistics were significant, with market factor displaying the highest significance as expected. In contrast, the constant term was generally not significant, which again is something we want to see and something that indicates that the model effectively captures the systemic drivers of returns. The model's reliability was further validated by an average R-square of 32%. Showing that the factors collectively explained meaningful portion of return variability. And actually, the R-squared fluctuated between 20 and 70% with peaks and troughs, suggesting that heightened idiosyncratic risks and unaccounted factors during troughs. When looking at the risk premiums estimated from this model, and we'd like to point out that this model output data from 2022 to 2024, just because we need to use some past data in order to estimate some certain parameters, and you lose some data. But getting back at the market risk premiums, they remained generally above zero, with occasional dips into negative territory. So here I'm talking about the market risk premium. Basically, this emphasized its significance in explaining crypto returns. And so the other factors also showed a time-varying behavior. Downside beta and liquidity often had negative risk premiums during this period, but occasionally turned positive during the analyzed period. Value and growth consistently delivered positive returns, on the other hand, although with some interruptions, while momentum performed well in bullish phases, but declined sharply during momentum crashes.
So the results were pretty intuitive as far as what you would kind of expect. And that's, I think, significant in highlighting that and expecting these kind of outcomes, right? But maybe we can kind of turn to the next thing and maybe go around the horn a little bit as we kind of get close to wrapping up. Maybe just kind of share, what you see coming next from this type of research, from this data, from these tools. How do you see this being used ultimately in the institutional space or in just, any space really with the crypto markets? And maybe we can just kind of go around. Christian, of course, you're our guest of honor. Maybe you start off first.
Well, to answer your question of what we can expect next, we will soon be launching a product based on this analysis that will allow investors to access each of these factors, the overall result that we mentioned here, as well as the underlying input data and descriptors. This will make the research actionable and practical for portfolio decisions. Stay tuned for more on this. In fact, very likely our audience will already be able to start seeing this in our quarterly reports, starting as early as this quarter. In terms of, future research, what comes next in that aspect? Well, we will focus on investigating additional crypto-native metrics and potential factors like staking activity, supplier inflation, on-chain sentiment to further refine the factor model. And so ultimately, I think that this work lays the very foundation for more robust tools for crypto portfolio construction and risk management.
I think Mark and I are really excited for that. Mark, we're really eager to kind of dive in and rip these things apart, start analyzing, what's driving the markets, and we'll try and include that into our quarterly attribution reports every quarter. Mark, what about you? What do you think is coming next?
I'm really excited when you mentioned the staking inflation and the on-chain sentiment. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing some of those results and getting that into our analysis, because that is a huge component with a lot of these tokens being more proof of stake and proof of work kind of dying out over the last few years. So that'll be exciting. I also just want to draw attention to what I saw in Exhibit 5 in our paper that was really interesting. We have our correlation matrix across the factors. To me, that's exciting just when I can, when thinking about the market, seeing that all of these factors actually have pretty low correlations with each other and can explain kind of different parts of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's pretty important. Thanks for bringing that up. I kind of was running out of time, but just a quick note on that is very important. The pairwise correlation between these factors, we find it to be very low, on average 0.1. The highest one we observe is between liquidity and downside beta. I think it was somewhere around 0.4, which is still considered moderate in this context. What one typically starts to be concerned when it reaches 0.6, which is still far in this case.
For me, actually, Christian, one thing I wanted to put to you, because clearly the paper rounds off by spotlighting areas of potential additional research, which I guess in a way opens the floor for, you know, external parties to take the ball and run. Of course, internally, this is not the end of the research, and there'll be further papers and further work done in this area to fill out the product offering that we have. I noticed that you underlined in this conclusion that crypto native regime models could be a potential area that could yield further insights and a better understanding of cryptocurrency, you know, return variation. Could you elaborate a little bit on that, how you see that working and what exactly you've seen within that that may yield additional value?
So I think there's multiple things to be done here. One example that I can give is, for instance, to look at the gas fee. So for our audience, the gas fees are essentially the fees that one has to pay for transacting on a given blockchain. Looking at how these gas fees change over time and splitting them namely into low gas fee environment, medium one, and a high one can also be something interesting to approach it from a crypto regime standpoint. And so I think that there's many things that one can do by looking at it from this angle.
That'd be kind of like a demand picture, right? That you're trying to pay with, as far as, you know, the gas fees are spiking, you know, are you seeing more demand to use the networks, to transact on the networks?
That would be really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to say one thing, you know, it's been a long episode, or it's been an interesting episode, but it's been a lot of in the weeds, which it's what we love. We love going into the weeds, talking about these concepts, which can be pretty hard to follow. So I just want to point everybody again to the paper online. It will help, I think, listeners kind of digest a bit more of all the concepts that we're covering here. And now I'm excited to see the pace that the crypto space is evolving. That's just one thing I want to say real quick. You know, CAPM was a single factor model, right? And then Gene Pharma and Ken French came up with a three factor model. And in 2014, I think they did a five factor model, right? And here we are in crypto. We've got seven factors in 2025 on crypto. And it looks like we're going to be adding more, but it just shows, I think, the fact that we've seen the market, you know, the market beta explain a lot of the returns, similar to how you see that in the equity markets. It shows how the market structure in crypto is kind of evolving. And it's becoming, in my opinion, to say like it's becoming kind of more efficient, meaning that you are being compensated for the additional risks that you're taking, you know, the market risk. And also these fundamental metrics, you know, that the team here has been putting together, such as, you know, studying the fee growth, seeing that translate to positive risk premiums is also encouraging from a practitioner standpoint. And I think it's going to build confidence overall for institutions to look at this as a legit asset class, seeing that the price action is kind of corroborating with fundamentals and also the market risks overall, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in essence, this work, just to get back at your last point, this work provides a familiar model applied to this new asset class. It debunks this myth that crypto returns are random, offering instead this structured framework built on crypto-specific data. And it's truly unique and again, cannot be found in TradFi. This particular framework empowers investors to build, to optimize and manage risk of their portfolios in this evolving world of cryptocurrencies, and therefore bridging the gap between traditional finance and digital assets.
Yeah, brilliant. And, you know, Christian, we are so grateful for you to come on to explain that and explain the aspects of your research so eloquently. So thank you very much indeed.
Nice to see you.
Yeah. So guys, yeah, there you have it. The key takeaway, if you had to boil it down to something really, really crassly, you know, small, this is not a random war. Cryptocurrencies as an asset class are validated by and vindicated by the fact that we've discovered these robust idiosyncratic risk drivers. And of course, this is just the beginning. So do keep your eyes open for further research and, of course, products that may be tied to the research that has been initiated within CF Benchmarks. As Gabe said, you need to have a look at this paper. You need to go to cfbenchmarks.com, navigate to the Research and Insights tab to grab a copy. If you've enjoyed the podcast, you know where to go. Wherever you find your podcast, Amazon, Spotify, so on and so forth, we have, I think this will be the 36th episode now. So we have several out there for you to enjoy. cfbenchmarks.com is the place you need to go for other information about CF Benchmarks and all of our content. Aside from that, we'll see you for another episode of CFB Talks Digital Assets. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CFB Talks Digital Assets. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice.
This recording is not intended to persuade or incite you to buy or sell any financial products noted within, including but not limited to exchange-traded funds, mutual funds, equities, other instruments that reference any index provided by CF Benchmarks Limited, or crypto assets. Any commentary, interviews, and discussions are opinions only and should not be considered a personalized recommendation. Please contact your financial advisor or professional before making an investment decision.